Hello and welcome to the second podcast in our series Translation and Territory, where we talk here at the Moore Institute at the University of Galway with a series of experts about the importance of translation in place, on the ground, especially in situations of crisis, situations of conflicts, and border situations. And to do so, today we have invited Professor Sharon O'Brien, really thankful for joining us here today. And Professor Sharon O'Brien is a professor of translation studies at Dublin City University, and she has published on a number of topics regarding translation, especially focusing on crisis translation, crisis communication, translation technology, machine translation, and the ethics of translating. Her publications are probably too long to list here, but to list just a few very recent examples. She recently co-edited for Bloomsbury with Federico Federici, the volume Translating Crisis. And one other thing that would be very important to talk about today is her recent collective effort with her colleagues Patrick Cadwell and Alicia Zeidel, where they co-published a report on Ireland's translation efforts during the COVID-19 pandemic, which is incredibly important and relevant. And so first of all, thank you, Professor O'Brien, for joining us today and accepting to do this.
Thank you, Andrea, for inviting me.
And so last time we talked about crisis translation, we talked about the importance of knowing the languages that are in a specific territory when there is a crisis, and we talked about the resources that are in place. And today with you, we would like to get deeper into the process of how it works and what is really the role of translators, interpreters in a crisis, because you talked about the transboundary nature of crisis translation and how crisis translation requires us to go across linguistic and cultural boundaries. And can you tell us a bit more about those boundaries and how in practice we can use translation to go across them?
Yeah, for sure. So I think normally when we start thinking about a crisis situation and the need for multilingual information, we're automatically thinking about translation and interpreting. Especially interpreting, I think, comes to mind in the stages of a crisis that most people think about, which is in the immediate aftermath of an event, like a threat of some kind. So if you just talk to people who haven't thought a whole lot about this, they think about maybe an earthquake or a tsunami or things like that. There's devastation and people need to know where to go and where to get fresh water and food and so on. And if you don't speak the language in which that coordination is being done, then you think immediately about interpreting spoken language translation. One of the things that we've been doing for many years is trying to draw attention to the fact that translation in crisis scenarios is much broader. First of all, it covers both written and spoken translation. Written translation also plays an important role, although it's less immediate than interpreting. But it plays a role in response, but also in all the other important stages, which is prevention or risk reduction in crisis. So that's really, really important. The role of translation and interpreting have, until recently, I think, been quite forgotten about in crisis scenarios. But one of the silver linings of the COVID-19 pandemic, I think, is that the need for very clear and timely and accurate information has become very well recognized by everybody around the world. And the need for that to be more in more than one language has also become very, very recognized. So this idea of linguistic boundaries in a crisis, I think, is something that we are much more aware of these days than we were in the past. But there are lots of other boundaries that might need to be crossed in a crisis in communications.
And what would that include? What will those boundaries be?
So when we talk about linguistic boundaries, very often we're just thinking about languages. So going from, say, English to Italian. But one of the things that we need to be very aware of in a crisis especially is that there are also cultural boundaries. So we all come with our own cultures, we come with our own understandings, we come with different levels of trust in terms of who is doing the communicating. So one of the examples that I used in the talk that I gave in Galway was around the Polish community in Ireland, who had different levels of trust in governmental issued communication compared to the Irish people who've grown up here. So whether or not this is a good thing, we trust our government. Whereas if you come from another jurisdiction, you might not trust the government as much. So this is cultural, and it's really then, you know, so if I have a Polish person living next door to me, they're hearing instructions from the Irish government on how to behave in a crisis, they may not actually trust that information as much as I do, because I grew up more or less trusting my government to some extent anyway. So even if the language is right, if we cross the linguistic boundary, we really also need to think about crossing cultural boundaries, looking at what are the cultural backgrounds and assumptions of the communities that we're trying to get through to, and trying to make sure that our communication is culturally appropriate as well as linguistically appropriate.
Yes, I guess that it also depends on the messages that different communities have received prior to the crisis. Because of course, during COVID, especially at the very beginning, I'm thinking March 2020, there was all this discourse about basically as if the whole planet was immediately everyone on the same boat, but we weren't. Everyone entered the COVID era, so to speak, from a different perspective, from a different background. And of course, the communication needed to adapt. And would you say it adapted? Of course, that's a very broad question, talking about Ireland as a whole. Of course, there were from the HSC to other many other figures involved. Would you say that there were examples of communication that did adapt in Ireland during the pandemic?
I think we had some examples of that, and we can look at the Irish context and COVID as a particular crisis that's still very much in our memories. I don't know if we can even talk about memory in relation to COVID, because it's ongoing still.
Yes.
But yeah, I think we did see some adaptation going on, because for example, one of the boundaries that I talked about that we need to cross are modality boundaries. So moving from just text-based or even audio-based messaging to video-based messaging, we saw more use of social media rather than perhaps just issuing documents on a website. Because as we moved through that crisis, we realized that there were lots of different channels that had to be used in order to get through to different people. So not everybody will click onto the hse.ie website during the pandemic. Many communities maybe didn't know what the HSE was. And even if you did you have access to a computer where you could get onto their website? So knowing that there are lots of different ways in which communication could be done and should be done, I think we saw adaptation going from more traditional ways of communicating to use of social media, WhatsApp groups and so on. But also, and I think this was something that's really, really important, we tend to get a little bit starry-eyed about technology in a crisis, and there's a lot of research about how important social media is for crisis communication, for example. Even more recently, we saw commentaries with the Twitter crisis that's going on how important Twitter is for crisis communication. Now, this is all really, really interesting because not everybody's on Twitter. A lot of people have recently left Twitter. If we're relying on a privately owned social media app for crisis communication, we're in real trouble. And I think crisis communication in general has recognized that you need to also rely on the old forms of on the old modalities of communicating, like leaflets, posters, radio is really, really important as well. So if we recognize that, we also need to ensure that the translation is happening across those different modalities as well. So I do think that we saw that adaptation happening during COVID-19 in Ireland, and hopefully we've learned some lessons about what's the most efficient and the most efficient way of getting through to communities who perhaps do not speak the dominant language in a particular crisis context.
Yes, and I was thinking when you were talking about this, it also becomes a question of literacy. Well, literacy in terms of being able to read a leaflet in a certain language or in a certain register, because there may be technical language, but also digital literacy. And when I think it's very important, because knowing your way around content that is being shared on Twitter, knowing your way about content that is being shared on WhatsApp. And of course, also there's also at that point the question of recognizing what is a reliable source and what is not. And you and your colleague decided, if I'm not wrong, to call your report on COVID-19 and translation in Ireland. There was translation and trust.
Yeah.
In the title. And what do you think translators can do to improve trust? Because some people may think, well, what is fake news and what is not should be left maybe to virologists in a pandemic or seismologists in an earthquake. And what is the role of translation in creating trust?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I should say that my colleague, Pat Cadwell, he's done his PhD on the role of translation in the Great East Japan earthquake. And one of the major themes or findings that came out of that research was the really important role that trust plays. Trust keeps coming up again and again in the discussions about communication in a crisis. Now, maybe it would be worth talking to him about this particular topic, but from an academic perspective, trust is a very complex concept. It's multidimensional, and there are many different ways of creating trust. There are many different requirements for trust. So we just acknowledge that for the moment, that trust is very, very important and very complex. So how can translation contribute to trust? Really, really important question. So first of all, obviously coming from translation studies, we would argue that professional translators and interpreters should be used to create crisis communication. However, we've also really acknowledged that in the chaos of a crisis, that is not always possible. Maybe the translation community themselves are affected. Maybe there are no professionally trained translators or interpreters in a specific context or in that geographic location or even available online. However, let's assume that we do have access to professional translators and interpreters. One of the things that I think we can do is to make those people less invisible in the communication cycle.
Okay.
Because traditionally translators and interpreters have been invisible. If we don't know that it's being translated, it's good. That's been the general principle. If you know that something has been translated, that's seen as being bad because it sounds like translation or it reads like translation. So traditionally, The goal has been almost to be invisible. Of course, that's changing over time. And now we really call for the recognition of the role of the translator and the interpreter in general. But if we could label a crisis communication piece as having been translated by a professional translator, I think that might help to increase the level of trust in that particular information. And that also brings up, of course, the role of technology and machine translation. And we have situations where, in general, machine translation is labeled as such. This was translated by a machine with no intervention from a translator. So we could, if material is being translated in that way, we could label it that way so people will know, well, maybe I shouldn't trust this entirely. And if it's labeled in another way, this has been, you know, looked at by a professional translator and has been revised accordingly, even though it has been translated by a machine translation system, I think that would also help to increase people's level of trust. And then, you know, just to think about sign language, for example, when we see the sign language interpreter on the news, I think that the visibility of that person, and especially during COVID-19, more and more people became aware of sign language and sign language interpreting. And they thought, this was great. Look at this. Like, oh, there's wonderful sign language going on for the deaf and hard of hearing community. And presumably that contributed to a level of trust as well, that, you know, those people who were getting the right information, obviously through a very professionally trained interpreter. So I think making the translators and interpreters more visible in the overall communication cycle would really help.
Okay, thank you. And actually, my next question was going to be about machine translation, because of course, it really, as you said, connects to the level of trust. And I would also be curious to know whether do we have data on whether people trust machine translation enough in a context of crisis or not? And that would be very interesting to know.
I don't think we have a whole lot of evidence or research on that. So people often don't know if something has been machine translated. If you say it's been machine translated, they might not actually even understand exactly what that means. So, you know, there are different kinds of technology, and we use the term machine translation, but in lay terms, this might be, you know, Google Translate.
Yes, a lot of people equate Google Translate with machine translation.
Exactly. And then do they even know what the potential issues are with some of those systems? So, you know, this speaks to machine translation literacy, which has been talked about quite a bit in academic circles, trying to ensure that people who are either end users or publishers of machine translation know when to use it, in what context, whether or not to label it as raw machine translation output, and so on. So I don't think we have enough data, but I would assume that people, because of a lack of knowledge, would generally trust what comes from one of those systems, especially if they've been working in language pairs that they know a little bit about. So if we go with English and Italian again as an example, because of all the data available, those MT systems are quite good these days. So if you just put one sentence into one of the online machine translation systems, you could be very convinced that human translators are no longer needed, right? When you get to the more complicated, nuanced, high-risk content, complicated content that will demonstrate to you very quickly that those systems cannot be relied on, especially when the content being produced, if misunderstood, could lead to a very bad outcome. So we need to ensure that people understand when machine translation could be used in a crisis and when it should absolutely not be used in a crisis.
At this point, I'm very curious, because sometimes crisis moments make for advancements in technologies, in methodologies, and did COVID-19 or any other crisis that you know contribute to the advance of machine translation as a technology?
I think now we are seeing quite a few themes coming into conferences on the topic of low resource machine translation. This has been there for a very long time, of course, but the focus has been slightly different. So for listeners, low resource machine translation is trying to build automatic translation engines using very little data, or relatively little data. So the more data we have for the languages concerned, the more likely the output is going to be good. We have languages for which we don't have very much data, or we have very limited digital resources for those languages. That means that the machine translation output is going to be not as good as for dominant languages in Europe, like English and Italian. So researchers have been trying to deal with that problem of data scarcity for quite a long time. But now we see a shift in the research community towards the practical application of that in crisis settings. So looking at how do we build better machine translation for situations like a crisis where the languages concerned might not have very many digital data, for example, or where we don't have internet connectivity to run Google Translate, right? So we might want to run something on a local server, or we might even want to run it off our mobile phones, but we have issues in terms of the infrastructure being down, connectivity not being great. So I think the researchers are starting to look more and more at how do we build systems that could function well in a crisis, in with languages and linguistic systems that are not so so dominant or so strong as the ones that they focused on until recently.
And I guess it all boils down to preparedness and what one crisis teaches you about the next crisis. And I'm also curious, what do the lessons that we have learned in the last 2 years especially, but also in everything that might have been happening in the world in the last few years, what does it teach us about the future of the translators and interpreters' professions and their role, the role of translation-trained people in the global society?
Well, one of the things that we have observed in some of the research that we've done is that perhaps there's a lack of preparedness amongst the professional translation and interpreting community for operating in crisis settings. Now, when I talk about crisis settings here, I am talking about, you know, pandemics, earthquakes, major disruptive events, right? Not pet food being contaminated type events. Okay. That's another kind of crisis that a translator might actually participate in. And although there are, of course, interpreters in particular who've worked in conflict scenarios or, you know, more crisis type scenarios, I don't think we have very specific training going on for how to work in these settings. Even if you are a translator and you're not maybe exposed on a front line, you're still maybe under a lot of stress, a lot of pressure to get material translated very quickly. And sometimes perhaps the material that you're translating is quite traumatic even to read. So we haven't really got a lot of training for professional translators and interpreters on how to mind themselves in these kind of scenarios. Like you have, for example, in psychological counseling, the counselors are trained to help them cope with the material that they might have to be exposed to. But translators and interpreters are just whisked into a difficult crisis situation, expected to do their job, and then they're sent home again. And we have no training for how they might prepare themselves for that, how they might cope in that very stressful environment, and how they might, you know, debrief or de-stress after it. So I think that one thing that we've learned is that we do need to look at that kind of setting and how to better train our translators and interpreters for dealing with those kind of scenarios.
Yes, because of course, as I always try and tell my students, it's words that go through you, and you as a translator play a part in it. And it is important to recognize that part, and it is important to also know of the consequences that it may have. It, because of course, it also may have social consequences, especially if there's I imagine social consequences of a crisis when a society is also divided. I'm thinking I wouldn't probably call a war a crisis, it's probably its own beast, but I'm thinking about the consequences for people who worked as interpreters for the US Army in Afghanistan and Iraq, and who had to live with the consequences, also social, of their involvement. And it's all part of what we tell our students, I guess, of the fact that there is no such thing as just translating.
Indeed, and you know, this links in with what we talked about earlier about the invisibility of the translator and interpreter, which is, I think, very close to the idea of the neutrality of the interpreter in particular, and how you are supposed, or were in the past, supposed to be this neutral conduit, as you say, through which words flow. But I think increasingly now there's acceptance that that is not even possible for a human being. You can't let words flow through you in that way without being affected one way or another by them. Yes. Sometimes if you're dealing with migrants, for example, they've been through very traumatic experiences. How could you not be affected? I know there's a bit of debate goes on about, well, professionalism dictates that you just translate or you just interpret, and you don't let yourself be affected by these things. Of course, that's not true. I think, you know, we've seen translators, interpreters in particular, saying that it's not possible for them to function in these kind of settings and not be in some way affected by what they've heard and what they've had to relay in terms of the meaning and the stories. So I think we would do right by the profession by ensuring that some training is available so people understand how to protect themselves and how to deal with any of those traumatic experiences that they might have to relay to other people, for example.
Okay, thank you. And I think that is, since we're also doing this for our students and hopefully for everyone who's specializing and learning more about translating and interpreting in the 21st century, I think that is a very good note to end our conversation. Okay. So thank you very much, Professor O'Brien. It has been very illuminating, and I think everything that you said is worth talking about, is worth disseminating, especially at a time where in the winter of 2022, when we're recording, when there is a concrete risk that what we have been through in the past 2 years will just be a page that we are really in a hurry to turn over and forget and do not talk about anymore. Whereas while this is understandable and on a personal and emotional level, very much so, I think it is also important for society in general, for linguists, for translators, for social workers to remember the lessons that we have learned in the past 2 years. So it is it has been a real pleasure. It is very important to have talked about. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you very much for allowing me to talk about it. And I look forward to hearing lots more podcasts in the topic. So thank you.
Thank you.